And welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
Hey listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue is the end-to-end solution for insight, outreach, and analytics for higher ed advancement and stewardship teams around the world. Recently, we launched Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub, where subscribers have access to over 100 hours of free, on-demand original series and podcasts, all created with fundraisers in mind. We're thrilled to feature the Development Debrief on Evertrue Studios podcast network. Check us out at evertrue.com/studios.
This week, we hear from Heather, who just relocated to Houston, Texas for a new role at Rice University. Once again, we focus on artificial intelligence, and she suggests a few places to start. She equates learning new systems like training for a marathon. Start small. Heather Kopeck brings an entrepreneurial perspective to developing annual giving strategies and integrating new technology to propel giving at Rice University, where she is the executive director, annual giving. Previously, she worked at the University of Miami, transforming the philanthropic giving and engagement program. At Virginia Tech, Heather led the annual giving team and was responsible for developing an innovative one-to-many fundraising program that increased alumni giving from 12% to 20% in 3 years. Additionally, Heather was the director of annual giving at the University of Wisconsin Foundation, where she reinvented the program and aligned campus partners and cross-functional teams to be at the forefront of best practices. Her career started at RNL, where she worked with numerous universities and organizations. Heather has a BA in studio art from Knox College and an MBA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's served on the Case District 3 Cabinet, Board of Trustees for Knox College, and Board of Directors for Free Bikes for Kids Madison. She received a 40 Under 40 award from Evertrue in 2020 and a 50 Under 50 award from Alma Base, powered by Blackbaud, in 2023. Now let's get started. Hi, Heather. Welcome to the Debrief.
Hi.
Tell us where you are talking to us from today.
Sure. So I am talking to you today from Houston, Texas, and it is roughly 76 degrees and sunny.
You just made a really big professional and personal move. Tell us how you came to that decision and what your thought process was for that.
Sure. So those who know me know I kind of chase big ideas, and I want to make a big impact in higher education. And so that's part of what drew me to the University of Miami. And when I started looking at, you know, what do I want out of my career? What are the experiences that I want that I'm maybe not getting in the role that I was in? You know, Rice and the recruiting company Rice was partnering with kind of put some of those things on the table of really taking a program and moving it to the next level, getting campaign experience, having major and principal gift experience. And so taking those things in addition to the core, you know, annual giving, technology, engagement intersection felt like this is a really exciting and fresh opportunity to kind of reinvent and reimagine a playbook. And so for those reasons, I, you know, decided to move to Texas.
It seems like fewer and fewer people are making moves like that. Was it daunting?
You know, there's always elements of that when you make a big move. I think one of the bravest things we can do as humans is step outside our comfort zone, and you see the world and you gain perspective in making those big shifts. And yeah, sure, it's a little daunting, but it's also nothing that you can't overcome relatively easily. And I think too, with so much technology has helped us, you know, like I got to learn all about Houston before I even decided to take the job. And so it felt very comfortable. And it, from some respects, felt like the easiest move I've made in my career because I got to know a city before I even landed here.
What technology did you use to educate yourself?
Sure. So I like, no shame, like Instagram actually helped me the most, right? Like something very simple that I just started looking at. You know, in Miami, it's called like Secret Miami. So I went and looked at, is there a Secret Houston? And right, once the algorithm knows what you're looking for, it just starts like surfacing you more and more content. And so it let me have a better sense of what was the food landscape and the culture and the social life. And I could ask better questions when I was interviewing. I could ask, you know, deeper questions sooner. So never underestimate the power of social media for good.
Definitely. Well, that's a perfect segue into our topic for today, which is artificial intelligence and all of the many algorithms that are getting started every single day, every hour. So you have done a series of presentations on AI. And before we talk about those specifics, how did you start to become a thought leader on this topic?
Well, I appreciate you seeing me as a thought leader. I really see as someone as, you know, very curious, and how are we asking big questions to continue to move our industry forward? And, you know, I make some jokes at my parents' expense in all the right ways, that, you know, my father's an engineer and my mom was a designer. And so I think about things in both those brains. And when I saw all of the challenges we have with people and turnover, I was like, there has to be technology that makes our lives easier. And so I leaned into that kind of background and that knowledge of let's push this and advance this.
So part of that was in partnership with Evertrue and part of that was on your own. Is that right?
Yep. Very accurate.
Yeah. So if you could just detail what that looked like.
So when I was at the University of Miami, we were an Evertrue partner. We used their core platform, and we also brought their digital gift officer program. And, you know, I'd had a relationship with Evertrue for quite a while. And what I appreciated about a lot of those interactions is we asked big questions. And I think when we started talking about AI and the role of ChatGPT back in November of 2022, I always found great partnerships with both like Molly and Brent. And when my team started using it, Molly and I would have some of those discussions, and it just kind of organically kind of became a conversation. And I got invited to be on a webinar with Cameron Hall out of the University of South Carolina. And so the content and the conversation from there, coupled with my research and kind of teaching I was doing at Miami, really helped us, you know, have a launching point for a larger conversation this spring.
And then the work on your own?
Yeah, I love technology. I'm always dabbling in everything new. I'd say even back in like 2019, we were training chatbots, and we were using, right, like early editions of AI powered technology. And so for me, it was just a deeper learning. And we finally had accessibility to some of these tools that weren't, right, that only industry was able to use. And so when ChatGPT came on board in like late 2022, like my team jumped in very early because we just saw a need for it to fill. And thankfully, because I had a decent background, we could do it with some of the safeguards in place right away before our institution was even having conversations about that.
So what did it look like in using that or adopting that? Like, what parts of the annual fund did you apply it to?
My team at that point was, I had a lot of brand new professionals who were really great at writing or really great at design, but didn't necessarily know the annual giving angle or didn't know quite how to start. And so we used it to say, hey, write me 3 calendar year end solicitation emails. And that helped, right? Something as simple as that helped my team start seeing context and having a starting point that if you don't know where to start, generative AI tools like really get you over that hump faster. And so we would do it as a team, and we would do it in a room together because it was new for everybody. So we wanted to create a culture where it was safe, and we were doing it in a way that everybody was learning. One of my designers got really, really excited about it. And so he started going even further into DALL-E to do text to image. And for him, that helped unlock some new visual ideas and helped accelerate his work that really let us think about a campaign in a matter of hours instead of a matter of days or weeks. And to have that extra time in your day, like, I don't know anybody who wouldn't want an extra like 2 hours in their day.
For those of us who aren't familiar, tell us about text image.
So I think that's one of the ones that's become both like very exciting and also very nerve-wracking at the same time. And we knew about it, some of those limitations when we started, but Photoshop now has text to image generation, and DALL-E is one of the original big ones. When you do it, you can write a prompt and say, give me an image with five students sitting under a tree reading a book, and it will give you something. However, what I also often very much teach my team and talk about with professionals is take a look at that image, because there's usually a lot of racism and bias and stereotypes that we see in these AI generated images that we don't always necessarily see in text. And so that's something that, you know, is a really big part of our conversations. Just like, yeah, I think everybody may have been aware of the Biden deepfake for audio, or some of the Taylor Swift deepfakes. And those are kind of the other end extremes of those, but we have to be talking about the good and the bad and having that careful lens, especially when we're doing with images, because that's where there's a lot of risk and a lot of, you know, potential for good upside as well.
And why would you use an AI generated image as opposed to getting a photo from the communications department archive?
So they don't have to be mutually exclusive. One of the great things is, like, if you have that image from archives, but maybe it's a vertical image, but the email that you're doing, you really need something horizontal, generative AI can take that image and maybe fill in some of the gaps, so the image looks like it was maybe horizontal all along. And that's a lot of what my team started doing really early, is we had wonderful imagery, but it didn't fit the size we had on the mail piece, or it didn't fit the ad that we were running. And it really helped take something good that we had and filled it in a way that we could then use it.
And what did you find with the text when you were generating appeals or calendar year end messaging? Was it, I know you have to edit quite a bit with ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. I've played around with it a little bit, but did you find that it was workable content?
I think if you, right, the biggest step you have to do is, like, get through that first step. And if it can get you an output in 5 minutes, then you can go spend the next 30 minutes editing and refining. But I would watch some of my writers spend hours or like half a day on a first draft. And if you can spend 30 minutes instead of 4 hours, like, you have so much more time to create more versions, or maybe go get a donor quote because you realize that's the missing piece. And it just lets you use your human brain so much faster in the process. And that's more rewarding for us as professionals at the end of the day.
I think what you just said is what I'm learning as I'm going through this AI theme for the podcast, is it's mm-hmm. not about replacing the human brain. It's about advancing the human brain.
Absolutely. And I know we talk, like, I've been talking a lot about, you know, the writers or people doing that content. And, you know, I say that with a lot of intentionality, because they often feel like this is coming for their job. And mm-hmm. I like to really talk with them about, if you had 2 more hours in a day to go get donor stories, or 2 more hours in a day to think about, you know, how this translates to video, like, how much more fulfilling is your time, because you're not stuck on something that's, you know, only one version of an email. I think it also lets us play with tone really quickly, that if you've written something and you're kind of stuck, it lets you play with, you know, I can say, maybe take this tone and make it both professional and inspirational, and watch how it changes those things in a matter of seconds that would have taken 15 or 20 minutes or even like hours in cases of like presidential voices.
Right. This might sound like an obvious question, but I'm interested to hear your answer. Sounds like you've been working with these tools for a couple of years now, and some people are just now coming to it, and it's maybe a little daunting or confusing mm-hmm. or foreign. Why do we need to prioritize AI today?
Yeah. I love that question. And I think that's part of where I, like, as a practitioner, I'm really trying to be at that forefront of, you know, why we need to think about this right now. AI as an industry and as a field is going to be, I think, potentially like $111 billion industry within the next like 5 years. So the idea that this is going to become any less of our jobs is a myth that we're all telling ourselves. And so when I think about, you know, my professionals on my team who are early and mid-career, I mean, even everybody to an extent, like we're all going to be talking with AI in a matter of years, not decades. And so the more we can learn of, you know, how to effectively communicate it, just like we had to learn how to communicate with Google and search engines, no one thought that was going to be something big. But if you type the wrong search, you get the wrong outcome. And AI is just like that. And I think what's where people don't necessarily think they have a place is there's been a lot of fear behind it. And I care as a practitioner of how can we demystify some of these things so that you just start using it and learning how to talk with AI tools and not be afraid of it. Because the biggest thing that we can do is nothing. And then we will be replaced by people who know how to use AI. It doesn't take a lot of work. You can become an expert in a matter of days and weeks. And it's not like you have to go to school and get a big degree. Like, we can all tackle this with a little bit of practice, and it unlocks so much more potential to bring joy in our jobs.
I will say, I think of it a little bit as learning a new app. You just have to practice with it and play with it. It took me a long time to figure out TikTok. And then once I did, I was totally addicted. So I actually had to delete it. But I think of it almost that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also to communicate with AI tools, like they all have, because they're based on the idea of like natural language processing, which, right, your words are the code. It doesn't matter whether it's ChatGPT or Google Gemini or Claude or Microsoft Copilot. If you can learn how to communicate with AI, you can transfer that from tool to tool. And that's not something that's inherently obvious. Like writing a good prompt doesn't matter which tool you use. That prompt knowledge translates to all tools and all kind of ecosystems.
So when you talk about becoming an expert, or at least just starting to adopt it today, for the people who are listening, like what are three things that they could do today to be more conversant in AI?
Yeah, I think the very first one is, especially if you're in higher education, go to copilot.microsoft.com and see if your institution's single sign-on pops up. If it does, you have a great tool that's already university approved. And what's great about it as well is that there's a kind of a data shield around your use. And so if you do accidentally put in donor information or an address or something sensitive or proprietary, it's not leaving your university's ecosystem. And so a lot of people, I mean, myself and my team included, just went to ChatGPT. And
that's all I've done.
Yeah. And Copilot is connected to the internet. Your university has your data protected. And there's so many great benefits that I would say like that is step one.
Okay. I need to do that too.
Yeah. And you know, my manager at Rice didn't know that we all had Copilot access. And I was like, there is something as simple as like trying that URL to see if your university has already given you that access. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like right step one. I would say, if your university has that or not, step two is going out and like researching just a little bit on how to write prompts or like prompt engineering. There are a lot of art, right? There's a lot of resources, a lot of free resources. And all you've got to do is pick like one or two articles and you're going to be writing better prompts and talking better with AI tools right away. And then I would say step three is committing like 5 minutes a day to practice. That you don't have to do a lot, but getting in there, trying something every day, it's just like running a marathon, right? I don't just start running 26.2 miles, I'll start walking and then I'll do a 5K and a 10K. And it's just a consistent practice, no matter what that looks like for you, that will really accelerate and put you ahead of your peers. And that gives you a professional advantage.
Yeah. So I know you've been in the new role a few months now.
Just under 2 months. Yeah.
Just under 2 months. So what have you already implemented with the Rice Annual Fund?
With the Rice team, we're starting to have conversations with a number of different vendors and partners to think about what is our AI ecosystem for our division. Okay. There's a lot of tools and a lot of options, but we also have to think about what's right for us and what vendors are aligning with those values and who's being transparent about the AI that they're using and their sub-processors and sub-vendors. And so we're really starting to think holistically about that. My team and our broader individual giving team, we're starting to do AI education and AI enablement. So my whole team has done, we've done a crash course on Copilot. We're talking about safety and risk and working on how to improve their prompt engineering skills because really that's step one. And so I was proud of like, I had members on my team that had already been using Gemini for a long time. And I was like, great, we're already starting at a higher level. And so now we're going to be having deeper and deeper conversations about, how to maximize our prompts and how to get to the answer sooner. And I think that's really like, that's a really great position to be in, that people are hungry for this knowledge. And some of them ask better questions than I did. And so I'm, as I just kind of tell people, I'm not an expert, I'm an enthusiast. And how do we have these conversations? And I love that there are people on my team who are already smarter than I am about large language models. I'm like, awesome. You're doing the next presentation when we go a little bit more technical. So it's a good place to be in.
And Heather, I have to confess, I don't know what Gemini is.
So Google, it's the Google version. So it was called Bard at one point, and now they're calling, I think Gemini is what they're calling it now.
Okay.
And so I always say, like, I put either a physical or a virtual like asterisk is like anything I'm saying, it's like as of today to be true. So if someone's
Right.
coming back in like 6 months and listening to our podcast, like Microsoft used to call Copilot Bing Chat. And so things just happen so
Right.
quickly that it's what we know today.
And large language models, can you define that for us?
Sure. So large language models are kind of what like a lot of the generative AI is built upon. And so OpenAI and ChatGPT are really the one that's become the most accessible. And Microsoft bought them. And so a lot of their tools with Copilot are based on that same kind of large language model. It's a type of kind of AI learning that's really connective. Whereas like Netflix uses machine learning, and that's an idea of if you like this, then you will like this, right? It's like 1 + 1 will equal 2. But large language models and generative AI are looking at like 1 + 1 = watermelon, right? It's creating something new and it's learning in a deeper way rather than just kind of a binary output way.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I think we see the machine learning with like online shopping and things as well.
Yeah,
Or
Nordstrom will always follow me with that pair of shoes.
yes, I can definitely relate to that. So it's great to hear what you're doing now. Are you already thinking about 3 and 5 years from now, or have you not gotten to that point?
I'm trying to be open-minded because right, I never thought like this type of generative AI would come so quickly and so accessibly. I think when I look at like my hopes for Rice are that we're really talking about an AI integration across multiple systems and using that to really help transform our mass marketing. So I think about what is the work that we're doing now that lets us be ready for when we're ready to make those big systems and technology implementations and making sure that there's a strong knowledge of AI and a buy-in that this is part of our future. I would personally would be really excited if we did start having more AI assistants that were helping do some of the tasks that we don't like doing. And so those are the things that I'm looking at of how can I educate myself on those areas and know when it's appropriate to advocate for them as a professional. So I keep my, what I do on the side on my personal computer. I take a little bit more risk on that, but when I'm sitting
Yeah.
with my Rice seat and all my Rice equipment, it's very much about what is the university said and what's okay to use within, my work laptop.
Yeah. That so my next question was actually what would it mean to be ready? So I hear you saying that training is critical. With another guest, we talked about data, like making sure that the data is clean. I see you're nodding. Very
I
much
think
so.
those are the conversations I'm trying to get. We were starting to have with colleagues at my last institution. We're starting to have those conversations here about that data. Because if your data isn't clean, AI can clean it to an extent, but it's always better if your data is cleaner going into it. Because if it's not good, you're not going to get what you want in the end. And I also think we're not having enough conversations about AI affirmation within data governance. but a lot of places and a lot of the conversations are starting from a point of fear. And like, these are things we don't do, instead of thinking about data governance and AI in an affirming way.
What's an example of that, do you think?
You know, I've got a peer at a state institution, and their policy on AI is like, you will not use AI on XYZ institution equipment until we can do a full audit of everything the university is using. And so that's a policy out of fear, instead of saying the safeguards of, these are acceptable use cases. If you hit like these data sets or this type of information, do not use it. And again, there's still a do not use one, but it's starting with the affirmation that we want you to use this. And here are the trainings and the safeguards and the considerations you need to make while you're using it. I think the other one that I look at as a practitioner and try to, you know, I haven't started those conversations here yet, but I think as professionals, we should all be asking questions about, you know, what was AI's role in informing decisions and making new policies? Because, right, generative AI is out there. And if we're all thinking about how it makes our jobs easier, if you've got to write a new policy, you might be using AI. And inherently with AI, there is bias and racism, and it kind of feeds on stereotypes. So making sure we're asking those types of questions when we're seeing policies or reports or new rules come out, like, we've got to keep that lens in mind of, how is AI involved in the process and AI involved in decision-making?
And just to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying, the racism and the bias, it's because AI is using what's online. So whatever is existing is what's going to come through on that tool.
Yeah. And because there is a limited amount of transparency of how large language models learned and what information they got, we've got to ask those questions to make sure we understand a little bit more about what we're getting in order to reduce some of those potential for, you know, racism, bias, and stereotypes to come through.
Or frankly, even like looking for them, which it kind of sounds like that's part of your training with your staff, is like, keep an eye out for it at all times.
It's on our checklist, and like the checklist we use is check one after you get an output is like, did generative AI hallucinate? And if it did, and if did or did not, does the output have any hints of racism, bias, or stereotypes? And really just putting that at the forefront, that we have to be really critical and use our brains on what we're getting.
In one of our prep calls, you made the comment that there's humanity in AI. Can you tell us what you meant by that and how we can identify it?
Yeah, I think, you know, generative AI tools they're getting smarter and smarter about mirroring human tone. If you put in the prompt about feelings, it's going to try. But at the end of the day, like, we've got to make sure we're bringing the empathy and the humanity back into the output. And that's where I really treat it as, generative AI tools are that first draft, they're your running head start, but we know people, feelings, emotions, ideas. We know how to convey that better than a piece of technology can. And so using that lens of, this is making my job easier so I can insert the humanity, is a really important part of this, whether it's this technology or something that's coming at us in 3 to 5 years. Like, we know our human selves better than technology, and never underestimate that power or that importance in the work.
Yeah. Well, this has been amazing. Is there anything else that we should know that you're working on or that we should keep in mind moving forward?
Ooh, I think one of the areas, and I have there's no paid endorsement. I am not affiliated with them, but I think as a professional, one easy way for all of us to stay curious and look at other like thought leaders who actually have degrees in this space, it's the team at fundraising.ai. They have a really powerful fundraising ethics and fundraising AI framework. They're really working on thought leadership for advancement. And I know they've done a series of like webinars and blogs, and I think they're going to be bringing back a free digital conference that they did last year. And so you're looking for like, okay, where do I start? I would absolutely start with that team out there and consider personally taking their signing their framework for ethical use in AI as a fundraiser. And you don't need your institution. It's, you can choose to do that or not as an individual.
That is so cool. That sounds like something I should do.
Yeah. Nathan Chappelle's one of the co-leads on there. I think he's brilliant and he really sees both sides of the coin. And he's also someone I would follow for really great, thoughtful content. And I think he's the expert in the industry, or one of the key experts in the industry for advancement and fundraising in this space.
And perhaps someone that we should have on the debrief.
He is brilliant. So I would absolutely reach out to him.
That's great. Well, I'm so excited for you with this change and this opportunity and all of the great work that you're doing. And I would love to close with my signature question, which is, what do you know for sure?
I know for sure that the sun will rise tomorrow and that my cats will want breakfast as soon as the sun rises.
So you didn't mention you moved with your two cats.
Oh, I have three of them.
Really?
I have three of them. So two of them are well-behaved and the other one just kind of chooses to beat to his own drum. His name is Freddie Mercury, so it fits.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Well, thank you so much, Heather, and good luck to you, the cats, and the whole team at Rice.
Great, thank you. It was wonderful connecting.